Welcome to Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley. With the campaign in full swing, debates almost over and manifestos launched, we really are approaching the business end of this general election campaign. From a polling perspective, we are seemingly inundated with numbers on an almost daily basis. So what are the numbers saying and who is having the best campaign so far? With me to discuss these issues and others, including the way that the media reports opinion polling, is Stephen Bush from The New Statesman. Stephen, welcome back.
Thank you. It's lovely to be back.
And Asa Bennett of The Telegraph. Asa, welcome to Polling Matters.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
So right then, what are our perceptions of the campaign so far? What are we, 2 or 3 weeks in now? The polling seems as clear as mud. I mean, Stephen, what sort of caught your eye? I mean, are things going as you'd expect, or are there things maybe coming up that you didn't see coming?
No, to be honest, actually, the campaign has been completely the reverse of what I had expected. Before the campaign kicked off, with that awful for Labour PMQs, I expected it would be exactly like the European election. Appalling interviews given by Ed Miliband, which were solely the result of bad briefing. It's not a judgment on your quality as a prime minister that you go on the radio and don't know who the Labour leader in Swindon is, but it is a comment on the quality of the people you hire and your judgment in hiring people. And during the last election in the Euros, Labour was hugely cruelly exposed, and I suspect it's one of the reasons why the Euros did not go well for them. I assumed this would be that again, because, bluntly, why would it change? No one's been fired. When you write the Euros went badly, you will still periodically get an angry phone call or be frozen out or be told that you're being difficult. It's just like, well, I assumed that it would be exactly the same. But actually, Labour has played a blinder so far. Ignore the kind of policy details and remember that elections are won on the kind of 2-minute snippet on music radio. They've basically every day of the since Parliament ended had a great story. Former Prime Minister endorses Ed Miliband, which is basically all that filters out into kind of, the non-political radio. Day 2, Ed Miliband stands up to the wealthy over non-doms. Day 3, they manage to throw enough dirt in the air to make the Trident thing an argument about the Tories being mean. Whereas the Conservatives, who, considering they've been briefing 4 or 5 years what the campaign they would run against would look like, they've just been awful. What is their message so far? They kind of went, they now have a manifesto which is going, here's all the bribes, but their campaign message is, stay the course, we think, it's a tough time. And I don't understand how it holds together. And I think the role reversal between the big two, between the Euros and now, is the thing which has most surprised me, I think.
So, Asa, I mean, to the untrained eye, the Conservative campaign does look a little bit confused, doesn't it? I mean, on the one hand, we're told it's about security, it's about competent economic management. That seems to be where they've been coming from day one. And all of a sudden, we've got all these sort of spending pledges. I mean, how do you sort of perceive the Conservative campaign?
Well, certainly it's sort of veering all over the place. I mean, first they're trying a sort of tactic you've seen in the 2010 campaign, when they had lots of business leaders come out and write a letter saying, we don't agree with Labour on this certain policy. Back then it was national insurance. Now it's the corporation tax that, the Tories are jolly good to have done, and Labour don't risk it. Ooh, they're scary, aren't they? But then you find that's not really sealed the deal yet, because obviously Labour is a different creature. They've been able to play it off as, look at them. We're against the 1%. Look at what they are. We are full working people. It fits their narrative. It's helped define them, actually. So you find that the Tories, regrettably, have started to sort of veer in not just knowing whether Ed Miliband now is suddenly so incompetent that he should never be trusted with the keys to Downing Street, or suddenly he's a ruthless backstabber. And you find there's that element of almost embarrassment in not being sure. It's sort of uncertainty in that Michael Fallon had one day where it was all about him, how awful Ed Miliband is. Everyone discusses that insult. That was to obviously brush over the non-dom day, which Labour had won. And then later on, people sort of don't really advance that. And suddenly it's all just hush, hush. We've got our manifesto now. Look, shut up, everyone. Here's our plan. It's, quite good. So, it's a good tune. And they just need to start ramming it home, though. They've just taken a long time to get to that.
But presumably, Stephen, there's still, certainly Conservatives circles, there will be a hope that there's still actually going to be this swing back eventually, this crossover, if you will, and that ultimately the polls are still neck and neck. And as we get closer to the voting day itself, the polls will swing the incumbent's way. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's such a cliche, but it is too early to tell. There is the figure that should make every Labour strategist lie awake at night is that 30% of the Labour vote, which doesn't think Ed Miliband should be Prime Minister, which in the forced choice question, which is one thing I'm very grateful to Lord Ashcroft for, is that is the question that both Labour and Conservative candidates say when some go, I don't know. They go, oh, well, who do you like to be Prime Minister? And Ashcroft now asks this every week in his marginals polling. And in every single marginal he's polled thus far, the number of people saying that they're voting Labour, they want Cameron to stay in number 10, you know, goes down in some. But there is no seat where if the Labour voters who are saying they'll vote Labour but want David Cameron to continue switch to the Conservative column or don't vote. If they don't stay with Labour, there will be a Conservative government because they would lose in Hove, they would lose in Morecambe and Lindsay, they'd lose in all of these seats where this good news is coming from. And, you know, intuitively, you would assume that that would happen. In 2010, just 5% of Labour voters didn't want a Labour government. And considering the result was a foregone conclusion, one assumes that would have been artificially high because you'd have some people going, I know that the results aren't going to go the way elsewhere, but I can keep my excellent local MP in the shape of John Denham, Sean McDonough, you know, those ones who held out against the swing. And, yeah, I think that third of the vote still indicates and is very much up for grabs.
Hmm. So what do you think? I mean, ultimately, the fundamentals, as Peter Kavanagh once called them, you know, at least macroeconomic trust and who makes the best Prime Minister, still with David Cameron. But of course, the mechanics of winning a popular vote or even winning the most seats are very different to actually forming a government, aren't they?
Of course, it's how you actually give voters that incentive to vote Tory. I mean, economically, they've got the best narrative right now. They are able to point to the economy. Indeed, it's taken a while to recover, but we finally got it recovering. And, instead Labour has to sort of sow seeds of doubt in voters' minds. And you find that instead the Tories are trying to put this message of reassurance, saying it's Prime Minister, it's a presidential contest. Look at David Cameron. He's competent. We slapped him on the front page of our manifesto with his team at Miliband. Where is he? You know, Labour would argue are embarrassed of him, but instead, it's a matter of personalities, whereas the policies in the manifesto were aiming to almost be quite defensive. They were filling the cracks in the Tory argument. They were, you know, something for defence in the hope that people would stop going to UKIP. There was something as well. There was that attempt to bung $8 billion to the NHS in a way of saying, look, we like it now, you know. So there's sort of nullifying these attacks. It's an intensely political game rather than purely economics from them.
It feels that way, Stephen, doesn't it, with the manifestos that, dare I say it, there's a lot of polling, evidence-based polling that's gone into it, in the sense that on the one hand you've got Labour who can't stop talking about economic competence, and on the other hand you've got the Conservatives really sort of trying to neutralise the NHS, haven't you? I mean, presumably the, you know, polling and kind of trying to neutralise weaknesses is at the heart of both major parties' manifestos.
Yes, it is, although I'm reminded of, and I'm not going to try and do an Australian accent, Linton Crosby's famous saying, yeah, you can't fatten the pig on market day. Yeah, if the Conservatives wanted not to go into this election however many points behind on health, then they just shouldn't have, as they now all admit, I'd say both in private, but they've now admitted it in private so many times it's been on several front pages, that they should not have even attempted to pass, let alone actually passing the Health and Social Care Act. Ditto Labour, this incredibly... I mean, it's the two Milibands, again, which were sort of put together in the manifesto. You have these wonderfully, very beautifully written long chapters written by Mark Steers and Jonathan Rutherford, and then these policies which have come right out of the Labour attack, let's poll test everything, here's what the focus group says, retail offers. And the problem for both of them is neither of them really fit together. My favourite terrible manifesto sentence...
is there a top 10?
I have a list.
Someone called John Ransell. Yeah.
Is Labour manifesto: Britain is bedevilled by low productivity and underinvestment, which is true. And then the end of the sentence is, we will aim to eliminate Wi-Fi hotspots. Not even a kind of there will be no Wi-Fi hotspots by 2020. Just obviously reducing Britain's terrible Wi-Fi coverage would be a brilliant thing for the next government to see to do, but it is miles short from the reimagining of capitalism that is being sold in some of the sections of that manifesto. And ditto with the Conservatives. they've gone from going, you can't trust Labour, they have all these unfunded spending commitments, to effectively going, we'll do all that with more. Childcare is my favourite. They have spent 4 years saying that 25 hours is too long and 12 hours is fine. They now have 30. And you just think, well, who is that aiming at?
Yeah. Mm. Well, that's the pragmatism at play there. I mean, obviously, most infamously, you find you've got the personal tax allowance, which the Tories are now really, really proud of. And yet, as the Lib Dems indeed would love to point out to everyone, David Cameron has said in 2010 leaders' debates, no, Nick, it's a lovely idea, but we just cannot afford it. And now you find it's in their manifesto, they're saying it's a crown and glory, and suddenly you find these slightly academic arguments about, no, actually, it's a Tory achievement, so much so that, you know, John Redwood was behind it, that sort of thing. It's a successful theft on their part.
I think the difference with the personal tax allowance is that they can do that because they've been in office and it's happened. They can't do with the trust us, the NHS is safe in our hands. And I don't actually think this is a fair characterisation of what has happened in health policy. But most people do think healthcare outcomes have got a bit worse, and it's because of that thing I think no one can really explain called the Health and
There's
Social Care
There's been some Act. Reforms.
Yeah,
it's got worse.
Yeah, that's the thing. They are responsible for it. They own it. Ditto, is it fair to blame the Labour Party for a global financial crisis? Of course not, but they were in office when it happened, and they used the phrase end of boom and bust. So kind of it's one of those things where, yeah, it might not be fair, but it's the situation you're in. And I don't think either party has really done enough to tackle its negatives.
So those are the manifestos. Of course, one of the other aspects of this campaign are the debates, insofar as we can call them leader debates. Well, I suppose they are. We've got the Challenger debates tomorrow.
Hmm.
What sort of impact do we think they've had on this campaign? We all know the last campaign there was a sort of Cleggmania. Feels a long time ago. But, I mean, Asa, what's been your perception of the impact, if any, of the debates?
I mean, this is obviously may seem a bit ludicrous to coin it, but there's some mild form of Millermania that had been happening initially when people discovered that, oh, there's Ed Miliband. He's not weird. He can talk. He can string sentences together. And, you know, he didn't just melt down when Jeremy Paxman asked him questions. He said things that, although to Tories, they seemed ludicrous, like, hell yeah, that obviously those people who were laughing at that, they would be the types who already think Miliband's weird. It's a confirmation bias. Mm. You know, they're not surprised. Yet you find that he was putting these points out, and it showed in the polling and that survation when they had the party leader approval ratings. I believe he then actually bounced into the positive net score territory rather than just being in the doldrums. But then after more exposure in the seven-way, I don't want to call it mass debate, but that's the word that comes to mind.
You've already done it.
Sorry about that. You may have to censor it. And after that, I think it sort of took the gloss, took the sheen off Miliband a tiny bit. At the same time, Cameron, who also benefited from this extra exposure from the leaders' interviews, it took the gloss off him as well. But you found that Miliband was less damaged and he was actually now in a better state than Cameron, which to some Tory strategists would leave them scratching their heads, given he's meant to be their biggest asset. It's meant to be the truism, the truth of politics, that Cameron is more popular than the Conservatives, Miliband less popular than Labour. So that's really been quite the result.
And before we go on to the Challenger debates tomorrow, I suppose there's two ways you can look at the leader polling, isn't there? There's a kind of, I don't know, approval or favourability metrics, which are kind of static and individual to each candidate. How favourable are you towards Ed Miliband? How favourable are you towards David Cameron? And then there's the kind of forced choice. Which one would you prefer to be Prime Minister? I mean, it seems to me that there's been movement for Ed in the kind of approval favourability stakes. Mm. But in terms of who makes the best Prime Minister, there's been some movement, but ultimately it's still quite decisively David Cameron that wins that forced choice poll. Which would we say is most important? Or do you on the one hand, you could argue that actually the forced choice is just a case of incumbency, or actually this is how the decision is going to be made. On the other hand, you could look at approval and say actually it's the approval rating that's neutralising the Millie scare, because ultimately they might prefer the incumbent, but as long as he's not scary, it doesn't matter. I mean, Stephen, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I'm going to do something you should never do, which is generalise from your own personal experience towards the overall. My instinct is that the best Prime Minister rating is more important than the job approval. And the reason why I think this is, you know, I'm a pro-European, I'm, you know, of the left. I would obviously prefer Ed Miliband to David Cameron. There has never been a week when I would have said I would prefer David Cameron to Ed Miliband. However, there have been many weeks, in fact, most weeks, when if you'd asked me Do I think Ed Miliband is doing a decent job of opposing the Conservative government? I would have said no. Do I think David Cameron is successfully being Prime Minister? I would probably have said yes. Those numbers can go up and down. Mm. They're a lot more variable. I mean, my favourite why didn't Labour Party make more of this moment from the Parliament is David Cameron saying, I don't know the price of bread, I have a bread maker. Labour have made more jokes about the bacon sandwich, which hurts them, than they have made about the bread maker. My assumption is that Prime Minister number is more likely to reflect what people want about their government, but I have no way of proving that.
What do you think, Asa? Would you agree with that?
I mean, there's some sympathy in that Labour has let itself be sort of outgamed by the Tories time after time, and that you find, you know, the bacon sandwich thing, they've almost adopted it as their thing. They were trying to make this very sort of Westminster-style, self-deprecating, ha-ha-ha, please like me now sort of thing. Whereas if you then seized on that bread maker thing, for example, you could have they could really embarrassed the Tories and then some, given that, obviously, Tories now like to caricature Miliband as some, you know, ultra-red, neo-Marxist, socialist, all the rest of it, and all those sort of words. I mean, they're playing the kind of implied class war card when they want to. And, you know, they're almost Labour letting them. I mean, rather than actually seizing the implied, you know, advantage of said rhetoric, in a sense, because they're just scared of, you know, the red Ed labels coming up.
Mm. I mean, we can't talk about this election without talking about the other parties. We know that, obviously, there's more than two shows in town. I suppose, generally speaking, the SNP have had an excellent campaign, haven't they? I mean, would we say that they're having the best campaign so far? Or if not, who might be? Because, I mean, I'll throw out the SNP case for that argument. They came into this campaign, you know, they had their poll surge before Christmas. Everyone assumes there's going to be some swing back to Labour. At the moment, it doesn't seem to be happening.
I mean, the SNP, they don't deserve to have the best campaign, but they're having the best campaign because the Tories have, you know, given them that boost. The way that the referendum has gone, they almost have their bogeyman. They have David Cameron in Westminster. It's a sort of Batman and Joker, in a sense. You know, Nicola Sturgeon and David Cameron, they need each other, they feed off each other. You know, without each other, they are nothing. And yet, so as a result, Sturgeon's almost this revolutionary. And, you know, just by being new in the lead, in a seven-way debate, she won them.
The SNP will not get more votes in Westminster than it got, you know, than Yes got in the independence referendum. So in another way, I think the SNP haven't had a good campaign. They haven't had a bad campaign. They're doing what we would expect them to get. I had a very bleak conversation with a Labour strategist recently, where they said, "I don't know. Increasingly, I just think this is probably normal." It was strange that a third of separatist voters were supporting an avowedly unionist party. What the referendum has really done is effectively rationalised the voting of people who want to leave the United Kingdom, and the SNP has held on to those votes. Yes, it's some voting intentions are showing them breaking the 53% mark, but I imagine that is just differential turnout and a sort of different level of enthusiasm. You know, it's very difficult for a Labour Party, which is led by a Catholic, to be a unifying unionist force in Scotland, assuming for a moment that they decided that was desirable. But I don't feel the SNP has had a great campaign. They haven't, you know, they haven't managed to keep a lid on their more aggressive activists, which is difficult for them, but it was an issue for them. It is one of the reasons why some people voted no. They still haven't got the economics right. There is an economic case that you can make for Scotland as an independent nation. They still aren't making it. They're still locking onto that 45%. I think in terms of their long-term aim, I can see how they will continue to get this dominant block of MPs and Westminster under first past the post, but I don't see what they've done to build out from 45%.
But are we exaggerating the relevance of the independence question in this general election for the SNP? I mean, it feels a little bit like, you know, UKIP. The UKIP vote is not about Europe primarily, really, is it? It's about things like immigration and sod the lot of them in terms of the main parties. I mean, is the SNP vote not really about getting those people that would vote SNP in a devolved election because they stand up for Scots to now do it in a general election because, frankly, Labour are no different to everybody else now?
Well, I mean, in a sense, the SNP are almost the Scottish UKIP. I mean, I realise they have a wing UKIP up there, but they're sort of being slightly drowned out by the SNP channeling this anti-establishment vibe. This sort of, I mean, when you look at the party conferences, the activists, when they're sort of delirious. I mean, there's only word that comes to mind. It's almost a cultish enthusiasm, it's sort of ecstasy about just being there. When if you go to Labour or Conservative conference that comes to mind, they'd be much more muted and just enjoying being around each other as a nice social occasion, although some people might complain, too many lobbyists, but what the hell, that's another debate entirely. Whereas, there's a sort of organic movement feel behind it. And so that, I can only imagine, then the turnout figures and general engagement on election day will show through.
Obviously, the Lib Dems and UKIP have launched their manifestos this week. I mean, who do you think is having the better of it from that perspective? Who would we rather be? Presumably, you don't have to vote for them, but presumably,
what from the Lib Dems manifesto launch day?
Who's had a better campaign, do you think?
Well, I mean, today I think it has to be you're choosing either between the Lib Dems, who, what was it? There was a power cut, and the mic went out when Nick Clegg was speaking. Or UKIP, who had a sort of Godfrey Bloom Mark II incident when our reporter Chris Hope asked a question of why was there only one black face on the manifesto when he got booed, heckled, jeered, all the rest of it. And, I'm only surprised that he wasn't, slapped over the head with a leaflet like Michael Crick had. But anyway, it had happened to him. But, so overall, both pretty shambolic. Mm. But then you find the Lib Dems will still be significant in the end. I mean, anyway, I'll probably end my sentence there.
Stephen, obviously, excellent New Statesman website, May2015.com. I've seen some tweets this afternoon about the latest sort of ComRes poll of sort of Lib Dem, sort of conservative marginals in the southwest. I mean, there's a bit of disagreement, isn't there, amongst pollsters, or certainly, maybe not pollsters, but amongst some of the data that's out there in terms of just how badly the Lib Dems might do. I mean, what's your take on that? Because I think that there is this big debate. We had Mark Pack on a few weeks ago, who said that you can't really do polling around the Lib Dems in their seats they currently hold without naming candidates, because it just doesn't provide an accurate reflection on how they're going to do. We've got the Commerce poll out tonight, which, it doesn't name the candidates. It does sort of to ask you about your local area, but it shows a very bleak picture indeed for the Lib Dems. I mean, what's your assessment on how badly or how deceptively well they might do?
I mean, I have a lot of respect for Mark Pack, but I feel that we simply don't know which way of doing constituency polling is better, and we won't. We will have a better idea after this election, but we still won't have enough data to be sure one way or the other. My instinct with the ComRes poll is, because it's across the battleground, and because the problem for the Lib Dems is they have so many wasted votes, we have no way of knowing if what that means is every seat where they ran the Tories close, they are just being blown away. Within where they're holding, they are doing rather better. That is certainly the picture in the Ashcroft, which obviously could be wrong, because again, we don't know what the constituency polling is. My hunch, again, this is just a hunch, is that it will be quite bad for them. It won't be as bad in the Tory-facing seats as the ComRes poll suggests. My guess is what will happen is some people who, the person who fought it in 2010 lost by 1,000 votes, will be crushed. They will finish third, they will lose their deposits. But I suspect within the places they hold, they will do all right. But that's just based on a hunch and my feeling on the ground. The problem for them is I thought their launch, I mean, I was there, so you kind of don't see the IT problems in the same way. I thought their launch was very good. I think Nick Clegg is still a very polished performer. But their big problem is that people just don't like him. They will never forgive him for breaking his word over tuition fees. That's how it's seen. And I just don't think that voters will ever, ever see past that again. I just don't think they'll ever get a fair enough hearing to ever be able to recover.
Because is Nick Clegg asking for nuance when the public aren't going to give him it?
I think it's he's got a very fine tone. And during the seven-way debate, I would argue that in performance-wise, he was formidable in that he had this line of realism of, no one's going to win. I'm the accessible guy. I'm the relatable guy. You can trust me, sort of thing. Which, on the face of it, if he did that in 2010, may have worked brilliantly. Trouble is again, as Stephen was saying, the voters will look at him and just think, oh, it's Mr. Tuition Fees.
Comes down almost, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. It's everything is just lie after lie, and you'll go back on your word then, and all the rest of it. And at the same time, he has a bit of a mountain to climb in terms of the believability of what he says. In that debate, he had this sort of almost quite useful differentiation of trying to go after David Cameron over certain cabinet decisions. And he kept saying, well, what do you think, David Cameron? What do you think, David Cameron? And you're thinking, you've worked with the man for 5 years. He's called David. you're colleagues. You can admit that. But obviously he has to put on a front. And yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I have no way of proving this, but it is just in my instinct that I wish politicians were less beastly to each other. Because I do just think that, no other industry do people who are competing against each other do they make outrageous and, in many cases, flatly untrue claims about their competition. If you started slagging off YouGov, the net result wouldn't be more traffic going to you. Yeah, it would be, clients pulling money from both of you. The Liberals have a campaign based on the idea that the other two parties are too ugly to work with and be trusted alone. But the Liberal Democrats are also the only party saying they will work with both of the two other parties. I just think that I don't see how it will ever be good for them to talk down politics as a whole. And actually, if they were going, look, I think a best of both worlds campaign would work a lot better for them than these two are awful, but don't worry, this other person you think is awful can fix it. Because unless the Liberals need a general uptick in trust of politicians, their deal-making, their honesty, and if that happens, that will benefit the Liberal Democrats. But instead, this very negative, very nasty, this slagging off of a guy he's worked with for 5 years and while attacking a man he may yet work with for another 5 years
you can't vote for a coalition, can you? You have to vote for a party, and they have to give people a reason to vote for them. And I guess the problem is that why would you, just objectively, why would you necessarily believe any promise that they make? Because the flagship one that most people know about, they broke, didn't they?
Well, exactly. And whereas they've still got that sort of identity problem. If you want to stick it to the coalition, you vote Labour. If you want to back the coalition, you vote Tory. What exactly are the Liberal Democrats, except for a kind of confusing traffic-based metaphor of don't go left, go right, straight on, and a kind of
hit by a truck.
Neither of the above, yes. But then I think at the same time, it's very easy to sort of start saying the last rites over the Lib Dems and, Nick Clegg's going to be out and all the rest of it. But they still will have presence. They still will be... There will still be some more than two in Parliament. I'm being flippant slightly. But whereas in UKIP, people are getting very excited about them. And yet you find... Obviously, since the heady days of the European elections, when it was, 27% in the polls, beating everyone else, it's now 13%, and you find that when voters are in that polling booth...
Single digits in some phone polls as
exactly.
Well.
Yeah. People are very shy about being UKIPers now. That's the thing. Not sure whether to back them with government.
Let's talk about the media and polling. Seems we have two media experts with us. One of the things that always, as someone that sort of works in the industry, I find myself banging my head against a desk quite often when I see these kind of sensationalist headlines that say, Miliband surge after debate, or the day that the polls turned. I mean, what's our perception? I mean, there seems like there's more data than ever before. I think that I don't have evidence to back that up, but I think it's a safe bet when you consider how much marginal polling there is and how many pollsters there are numerically. I mean, what do we make of the way that the media sort of report on some of the polling out there?
Well, certainly, thanks to new entrants like Lord Ashcroft and Servation, you find that there is more of a wealth of data. And so you might find some bloggers, some analysts, etc., able to try and construct their own preferred narratives. It's just a matter of when you look through this, what's the trend? Mm-hmm. At the same time, with Twitter, politics moves quicker, and so do polling crazes. And that you found, on Monday, the ICM poll saying the Tories are marching ahead, 6-point lead, this is brilliant for the manifesto. And then suddenly Lord Ashcroft cut it down, saying, hang on, your Tories, Labour, still 33-33, nothing has changed.
I mean, Stephen, do you think that a lot of the media reporting of polling is dishonest, or do you think it's just kind of filling column inches? I mean, kind of, are we being unfair? Actually, the majority of journalists do report it pretty well, and actually, there's just a couple of occasional headlines that are you know, maybe a bit ropey, but actually the general standards of transparency and things are pretty good.
I think there is, I mean, there are, I think there are three problems. One, understandably, if you've paid for a poll, you need to get some bang for your buck. So the Sunday Times with their, I can't remember if it was Millabounce or Tories on the Brink, but yeah, it was, you know, their poll showing a big lead. But ultimately, they've, you know, they've given you quite a lot of money for that poll. There is a need to, when it does something interesting, go, look, look, look at everyone, look at what we've got. I think it's understandable to see that in the headline. I think it is good in the copy, and obviously space is doing it, but it's one of those things where, you know, the copy and the headline have to be taken together, and I think journalists are getting increasingly good about kind of writing up in a way which goes, well, actually this, well, actually that. There are some...
They often don't write the headlines themselves either, do they?
Mm. There are some journalists who don't understand polling. I think because it's also about the generation that you are in. In, you know, the 80s and 90s, there were sort of these one-off polls and then weeks and weeks of silence, which meant you did have to crowd around them and write them all up and go, oh, well, isn't this amazing? What does this tell us? And I think that generation of journalists still kind of sees a poll and goes, oh, my God, a poll. Whereas I think then younger journalists tend to look at them and go, oh, well, another one will be along in a couple of minutes. Mm. Let's wait and see. So I think it's partly a generational thing. I was rereading Life, Birth and Death of the SDP and realising how much, you know, you did just have months go by and there'd be no new information and suddenly everyone would go, oh, we've gone up, oh, we've gone down. And now we look back and go, well, do we know for certain if they were ever up or down? You know, there simply wasn't enough to tell. I think, yeah, The Guardian's, partly because I'm not doing The Statesman, do you honour if I don't slag off the competition? The Guardian's When the Polls Turned was... a particularly strange one because they hadn't paid for any of those polls. Mm. And obviously at this point in the 2010 election, the Lib Dems were first in some polls, so it is far too early to say. But I think equally it is very easy for me, someone who works at a weekly and is, you know, wholly digital most of the time, to go, oh, why have you done that, when you do have the space to be more considered. Certainly on a quiet day when I was, you know, doing something daily, you would occasionally go, poll, it's important, here it is, because you have to fill the inches somehow. So I think it's partly a problem of medium and message. But I think, as things get longer, partly because one of the problems with Twitter is it makes political journalists and politicians think politics is moving quicker than it ever has. I don't think for most voters it is. Mm. And actually, there'll be, I imagine, a necessary correction, either after this election or the next, when we suddenly go, actually, we can be a bit slower, we can be a bit more considered, and that will be good for discourse.
That's true, isn't it, Asa? Because actually national voting intention polls haven't really moved that dramatically, have they? If we exclude these kind of six-point leads either way, whether it's panel base for Labour or ICM for the Conservatives, actually, the story's pretty consistent. And yet, I'm guilty of it as well, as one of these kind of political junkies, we all kind of jump on the latest poll, where actually it's not moving that much, is it?
Well, exactly, but then... we obviously like to shake things up when there's something that breaks the narrative, as you saw with the independence referendum campaign, and there was that YouGov poll that's now infamous, saying, yes, are in a 2-point lead, and suddenly everyone was terrified, everyone was scared, and obviously Twyman's law went out the window, you know, that errant poll was apparently, you know, on the money, and obviously, as Alex Salmond found on the day, from his research being based on Twitter, you know, then it didn't come through.
I'd love to know how much they paid for that research.
Oh, I know.
I mean, given that we've got three weeks or so out till voting day, losing track of the days, blame Arizona jet lag. At what point do we call this for Labour and Ed Miliband in terms of Miliband forming a government? I mean, it seems like this Tory crossover isn't really happening, or there are some people that suggest it might be on the telephone polls. Mm. I mean, when we just take a step back and forget vote share and seats, almost, it's really difficult to see how David Cameron can form a government, isn't it? Or do we think that actually there could be this ever so slight late surge in the seats that matter that help him cling on?
Well, I mean, even if he did lose, he would still be Prime Minister for at least a few days or even weeks, depending on coalition negotiations. So obviously for those type of bets you can take out where it's who's the next Prime Minister, you want to be very careful about the wording. And at the same time, I think I'd be slightly sceptical and a bit boring on this. Given how inevitable it is that there would be a hung parliament, it almost would be too early to call it for Ed Miliband, given that you almost have to wait to see what people find out in the, you know, negotiating rooms, in the smoky back rooms, when they see what they can put together.
Mm. Do you agree with that?
it's difficult because so.
Because the central point, isn't it, is that you know, actually the Conservatives to get 323 seats, with, well, not themselves, but as a sort of coalition or some form of agreement. Even that, actually, 323 is not really good enough to form a functioning government either. It's just hard to see how that happens, isn't it?
It is really difficult to see a path to a Commons majority, you know, a bare one, let alone a workable one for David Cameron. It does look increasingly like... I am not for a moment saying I think the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives are the same, but from a parliamentary mathematics perspective, that is the only party that can plausibly help him. It looks like the only seats he can win are at their expense. It looks increasingly likely, you know, Danny Alexander is definitely gone. Nick Clegg may well be gone in Sheffield Hallam. At that point, who are the people to bring those two parties together? Yeah, it does look quite ugly. My problem is I look at the numbers and my head says there is no plausible combination of numbers and swings that can produce a Conservative government. But I'm afraid I still, at every election since 2010, Labour has underperformed the polls slightly. Yeah, 2012 was a good election for them, but it wasn't as good as the polls said it was. 2013 was a disappointment. 2014 was obviously a massive disappointment. And I am just nervous about whether or not we will wake up and find that... Yeah, I mean, if Labour gets only a 1% swing in England, if they pick up maybe 10 more seats, or, you know, 20 more seats, well, then actually when they get wiped out in Scotland, they're basically back where they were. But I don't see how... Yeah, I think the one thing that is certain is that the next government will not have as big a majority as this one. I still don't see where the majority for Cameron to stay in number 10 will come from, but I fear that it will emerge.